Good morning or good afternoon, depending on your time zone. I am Marty Otto. I'm also, along with Gene, in the Technology Innovation Office of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Superfund program. The Superfund program is one of the agency's hazardous waste site cleanup programs. This webinar was organized by U.S. EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division and the not-for-profit UK organization called Contaminated Land Applications in Real Environments, also known as CLARE. The purpose of this webinar is to hear presentations on site remediation projects where nanoscale zero-valent iron has been used as a remediation technique in a practical way, and also to consider the risks versus the benefits of iron nanoparticle use for remediation. So we're on slide 3. I am going to give you an overview of the use of nanoscale zero-valent iron for site remediation. We can move on to slide 4. I will provide a little bit of background, an overview of the technology, some of the benefits and limitations of the technology, the extent of use, also a little bit about outreach and needs and next steps. Next slide, slide 4. Oops. Sorry, slide 5. Nanotechnology is the understanding and control of matter at dimensions between approximately 1 and 100 nanometers, where unique phenomena enable novel applications. The size of a nanometer is 1/1000th of a meter. And on the left of the slide, you see a micrograph that is a human hair with a nanowire on top of it in a loop. And on the right, you see some micrographs that indicate the size scale that we're talking about. For instance, a DNA double helix is about 2 nanometers wide. And at the nanoscale, materials may exhibit unique properties not seen in the same material at the macro scale. For example, you may see increased reactivity, unique mechanical, electronic, or magnetic properties. And so nanomaterials are being used in a wide range of applications. The Woodrow Wilson Center has a database with over 1,000 consumer products that contain nanomaterials. Next slide, slide 6. Our focus today is on the use of nano iron particles for site remediation, but I wanted to first talk a little bit about the size of the problem. This chart provides information on the types of waste sites in the U.S. that will require cleanup over the next 20 years or so, around 400,000 to 500,000 sites at a cost of about $300 billion. And this estimate is a few years old. Next slide, please. Slide 7. Contaminated groundwater is a major problem in the U.S. More than half of the U.S. population relies on groundwater for drinking, and over 80% of our Superfund sites have contaminated groundwater. Pump and treat has been the traditional remedy, but of the 725 pump and treat Superfund remedial projects, few have met cleanup goals. Pump and treat can be costly and time-consuming. We are getting better, but remediation of groundwater remains a challenge, especially for some sites with dense non-aqueous phase liquids, or DNAPL. For instance, trichloroethene or perchloroethene. Next slide, please. We're on slide 8. Because of the high cost and lengthy operating periods for pump and treat remedies, the use of in-situ groundwater treatment technologies is increasing. And one such application involves the injection of nanoscale zero-valent iron particles into contaminated groundwater. This is a reductive dechlorination method, and the most important reaction mechanisms are are beta elimination or hydrogenolysis. I'm not going to go into detail about the chemistry because other speakers will cover that. Next slide, please. We're on slide 9. Some of the potential benefits of iron nanoparticles. These are extremely small particles, around 100 to 200 nanometers, some smaller. They have a high surface area to weight ratio. They're highly reactive. They can be directly injected into contaminated aquifers. You can end up with faster cleanups, potentially lower costs. They have the capability of degrading multiple contaminants, including chlorinated hydrocarbons, pesticides. They can be used to, they potentially can be used to immobilize metals. They can also address inorganic anions, for instance, perchlorate. Next slide, please, slide 10. However, how effective the treatment will be depends on many factors. First of all, adequate site characterization is critical. Some of the factors that affect the success of a project include the geologic conditions, for instance, the soil matrix, the hydraulic properties of the aquifer, the depth to groundwater, geochemical properties like oxidation reduction potential, the pH, dissolved oxygen levels, the concentrations of nitrate, nitrite, sulfate. Also the concentration of contaminants present. There is also a challenge to monitor the distribution of the injected particles. We really do not have good cost-effective methods to detect nanoparticles in environmental media. But some might say that that isn't really a problem because bare nano iron particles tend to agglomerate and they don't move very far from the point of injection. There's also a potential problem with passivation of the particles. Generally, the nano iron particles are transported as a slurry under a blanket of nitrogen gas to keep them from becoming oxidized. There's also a challenge to get the nano iron to the contaminant. As I mentioned, the particles tend not to move too far from the injection point. You often hear that these particles will only move as far as you push them. In other words, they're using pressurized injection. There are also issues of potential toxicity and safety. Next slide, please. We're on slide 11. So in terms of potential implications, there are some concerns about using nanomaterials for this application, for site remediation. More research needs to be done on potential toxicity and fate and transport issues. For instance, could the nano iron particles mobilize certain contaminants within the aquifer? Also, researchers are modifying the particles, for example, using surface coatings to improve the stability and mobility of the particles. But we need more data on the fate and transformation of these modified particles. There's been research that indicates that direct exposure of cells to nanoscale zero-valent iron particles may lead to oxidative stress. So here we're talking about potential toxicity, but surface modifications may reduce the toxicity. Next slide, please. Slide 12. There have been some improvements in the technology. For instance, more and more folks are using pressurized injection. Also, I mentioned there's some research on modifying the particle surface to improve stability and mobility and potentially decrease toxicity. Some folks are encasing the nanoparticles, for instance, in emulsified oil, or sequestering them in a matrix, for instance, using swellable silica or activated carbon. Also, some researchers are devising ways to actually create the nanomaterials in situ in the groundwater. Some researchers are using the particles to form a soft curtain permeable reactive barrier by injecting the particles in a row of injection wells, resulting in overlapping zones of influence. Next slide, please. We're on slide 13. My office is collecting cost and performance data for field tests where nanomaterials have been used for site remediation. We have information on 36 tests, including 7 full-scale and 30 pilot-scale. That adds up to 37. That's because one included both full-scale and pilot-scale tests. So most of these sites are in the U.S. 2 of them are in Canada. We also have information on an additional 46 sites, but not enough data to post them online. So we're still collecting data on those additional 46 sites. And those include projects in Italy, Czech Republic, Slovakia, and Canada. So of these 36 tests, the nanomaterials that were used were mostly iron-based, but also included one where nanoscale calcium was used and another where zero valent zinc was used. But the majority of the field studies had trichloroethene or trichloroethane as the main contaminant of concern. Most of them used either gravity feed or low pressure injection to deliver the particles to the zone of contamination. And for many of them, the goal was source zone remediation. Next slide, please. This is slide 14. This just shows the type of site for these 36 field tests. And some of them were federal facility sites. Some were cleaned up under the Superfund program or CERCLA, and others under RECRA, which is another of our cleanup programs. Some had the state leading the cleanup, and others were private sites. Next slide, please, slide 15. This is a breakdown of the particles used, and I've already discussed this, that most of them were NZVI and other forms of iron. Next slide, please, slide 16. This is an example of one of the sites where we've collected information. This is a BP site in Alaska where they cleaned pipes used in the oil well construction industry. And the main contaminants in this case were trichloroethane, diesel fuel, and lead. The goal was to reduce the trichloroethane. And then with the idea of seeing what effect it might have on the diesel fuel and the lead, there were 2 different test areas at this site. One was a shallow test area where they actually dug up the contaminated soil, physically mixed it with the NZVI, and ended up with a trichloroethane reduction of about 60%. Another area involved injecting the particles into the subsurface, and in that case, they did have some wells that showed TCA reduction up to 90%, but they did have some problems with getting the nanoparticles to move very far from the injection point. Next slide, please, slide 17. This shows a micrograph of an emulsified zero-valent iron micelle. This technology has been used at a number of sites throughout the country. I've highlighted 3 here in Florida. The EZVI consists of a slurry of nanoscale and micro-sized iron surrounded by a film of oil. The oil membrane is hydrophobic, therefore it's miscible with DNAPL. You would end up with abiotic degradation by the ZVI, the zero-valent iron, but biodegradation may also be enhanced by the vegetable oil and the surfactant components. Next slide, please, slide 18. This slide shows the use of visual observation of the EZVI in soil core samples. So this is one way to try to track the movement of the nanoparticles in the subsurface. Next slide, please. Slide 19. The U.S. Navy has used nanoscale iron at a number of sites, including Hunter's Point, where they have some ongoing work. I'm going to quickly go through the rest of the slides because I'm running out of time. Next slide, slide 20. This shows some interesting research that's being done by one of our EPA scientists, Dr. Rajender Varma. And he is working with plant extracts to find new ways to form nanoparticle zero-valent iron in soils, in situ. Next slide, please, slide 21. This shows this provides some information on swellable organically modified silica, or SOMS particles, or technology. This material can absorb organic compounds. It swells up, but it does not absorb water. Next slide, please, slide 22. With this technology, the NZVI is sequestered in the silica matrix. The matrix can absorb the TCE. The TCE is degraded by the iron. Then the silica shrinks, and when additional TCE comes into contact, it will swell and degrade that TCE. So it shrinks and expands. It's been used at several sites in Ohio. At one site, the material was injected in a row of wells to create a soft curtain permeable reactive barrier, as I described earlier. Next slide, please, slide 23. These are some websites where you can get additional information. My office has produced a fact sheet on the use of nanomaterials for site remediation. We also have the spreadsheet with the cost and performance information on the field test sites. Also, some additional resources are listed here. Next slide, please, slide 24. This is a new technology focus area where you can get additional information, and there are additional resources listed. This is on our cluein.org website. Next slide, please. Number 25. We do need additional research. We need some more research to improve the nanomaterials, their stability, mobility, reactivity, to reduce toxicity by design, also fine-tuning the field application. As far as toxicology goes, we need additional research on the potential health and environmental effects, whether or not the materials might affect soil microbial populations. We also need, we're desperately in need of additional information on fate, transport, and transformation. We need some cost-effective methods for detecting the nanoparticles in environmental media. We would like to determine at a distance from the injection point whether or not they're still in nano form, what the concentration of the nanoparticles is. Also, we'd like to measure the valence state of the iron, and would like to measure the distance traveled in groundwater. And finally, outreach, providing technical support to field offices, also documenting additional cost and performance case studies. Next slide, please. Last slide, and I would ask Jean whether or not we have any time for questions at this point.
We did have one question that came in, and I'm just going to go through the one question, Marty, and then we'll transition over to the next speaker. And the question that came in online comes from actually Vienna, Austria. And this question asks, why is toxicity of ZVNI at highly contaminated sites a major issue? ZVI will transfer to iron oxide bacteria, and it will only be affected temporarily. So at a perspective of a year or two, I do not see a risk being higher than intrinsic the risk of the site itself.
And I believe that is generally the feeling that when you inject the nano iron particles into the aquifer, they will react either with contaminant or with other constituents of the groundwater. They will the iron becomes oxidized and will precipitate out if it's fully oxidized. I think the concern is that with modifying the particles to increase their stability and mobility within the aquifer, there is the potential that we might do too good of a job, or perhaps there would be some fractures where you might have the potential for additional mobility. But we will certainly address this with the subsequent speakers. We'll address it, and we can talk more about the risks versus the benefits after our presentations.
Okay, excellent.
Okay. So, moving on to our next speaker. Our next speaker is Daniel Elliott. He is with the UNC, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and also with GeoSynTech Consultants. And Dr. Elliott will tell us about some field applications of the technology.
And this is starting on slide 27. Dan, you can go ahead and take yourself off of mute or hit #6 to unmute your line.
Thank you very much, Jean and Marty, for that very nice introduction. It's certainly a pleasure to be with everybody today. Given the brevity of this talk, I'm going to be focusing on the decade of NZVI fieldwork at a manufacturing site in Trenton, New Jersey, which I think our experiences there effectively illustrate both the promise as well as the challenges associated with field use of this technology. Next slide, please. Everybody should be on slide number 28. By way of an outline, I'll start the talk with some perspectives on the transition between bench scale NZVI success and field scale field implementation. We'll then go into an overview and provide context for the case study, followed by a survey of the principal findings from the field work. We'll then move into a brief discussion of the key implications and issues as I see them associated with this very exciting technology. Finally, I'll close with some parting thoughts. Next slide, please. You should be on slide number 29. Bench-scale studies using representative groundwater from the site and, if resources permit, aquifer media are strongly recommended to demonstrate that the chemistry works. With respect to the actual chemistry itself, ZVI's primary function is to provide electrons, leading to the reduction of the contaminant. Therefore, contaminants that contain relatively oxidized points of attack tend to be amenable reductates. A great example are the chlorinated aliphatic hydrocarbons, well known by all remediation practitioners by virtue of their ubiquity in the environment. Because of the multiple carbon-chlorine bonds with the highly electronegative chlorines helping to drive the process by serving as a lightning rod for the electrons provided from iron. A key point here is that favorable bench scale results do not necessarily translate into field success. This stems from the dramatically higher level of complexity associated with field applications, factors including the degree of mixing, presence of multiple impacted media, and transport issues, not to say the least, all influence the contact opportunities between the contaminant and the NZVI. And we all need to bear in mind that NZVI-mediated reactions are surface processes. Finally, the process of scaling up the ZVI treatment can be very site-specific and hard to compare from site to site. Next slide, please. We should be on slide number 30. There are several important drivers for considering NZVI. These include flexible field deployment of injected NZVI slurries, which can be deployed via conventional well infrastructure or via direct push geoprobe type borings to the desired target depth intervals. Moreover, both the technology is amenable to both treating dissolved contaminants and plumes as well as free-phase denapple source areas, although the deployment strategies for these sorts of cases will differ, certainly. For contaminant classes like the chlorinated aleph hydrocarbons, there can be significant technology synergies such as exist between anaerobic biodegradation of the contaminant as well as abiotic degradation by the iron itself. This can be explained in part by the ability of the ZVI to reductively split water into hydrogen, which is the universal electron donor for anaerobic biological processes, and hydroxide. Next slide, please. Should be slide number 31. This slide actually depicts the profound water chemistry changes that can be elicited by NZVI reactions in the aqueous environment. Here we're looking at the results from an addition of a 0.1 gram per liter iron into deionized water under well-mixed batch study conditions. Shortly after contact, we see the complementary pH and OR oxidation reduction potential curves. pH increases by virtue of the hydroxide being formed, while the ORP drops precipitously in response to the formation of hydrogen. In the field, the magnitude of these changes is certainly more muted, but can still be very significant and last for an extended period of time. This is important because secondary anaerobic biodegradation processes can be stimulated by the dissolved hydrogen and the attenuating pH that can result. Next slide, please. We should be looking at slide number 32 now. Some brief perspectives on the NZVI technology. Over the last 15 years, since the initial proof of concept work at Lehigh, and the decades since the first field demonstration, it has become the subject of burgeoning interest in the academic, consulting, and regulatory communities, much of it in the last 5 years. However, many fundamental issues and questions remain. At the time of the first field test in New Jersey in 2000, there were no commercial purveyors of nanoscale zero-valent iron. We indentured servant graduate students had to painstakingly make the stuff by hand in the lab. Now, a decade later, there are many commercial vendors of a pretty impressive array of NZVI products available worldwide. Next slide, please. This slide, number 33, shows some of the different types of iron that are out there. Most pension field scale work is focused on bare NZVI without amendments. NZVI, as is now well known, tends to aggregate quickly by virtue of its magnetic self-attraction and low surface charge. Iron aggregation can significantly impact the handling, injection, and subsurface mobility capabilities of the iron. Bimetallics is another variety of NZVI, usually pairing iron with palladium or other catalytic metal, and these materials tend to be favored when dealing with highly recalcitrant contaminants like the chlorinated aromatic hydrocarbons, PCBs, hexachlorobenzene, things of that nature. Emulsified iron, or EZVI, features iron within a nonpolar emulsified oil micelles that are well suited for the treatment of source areas containing residual DNAPL. Finally, a lot of research is now being focused on surface-modified NZVI with iron, featuring iron outfitted with various surface architectures designed to impart a permanent surface charge, lessen aggregation, and help target source areas. Next slide, please. This should be slide number 34. Our case study subject is an active manufacturing site in Trenton, New Jersey, one of the last from the city's industrial past. The site has always been in the metals fabrication industry, making products including springs, appliances, and HVAC equipment over its long manufacturing lifespan. Extensive site and remedial investigations of soils and groundwater have been underway here since about 1990. Major contaminants include the full suite of chloroethenes, TCE, cis-TC, and vinyl chloride, as well as BTEX associated with former fuel-related USTs. The contaminant plume in groundwater was well delineated with strong evidence of ongoing reductive chlorination apparent prior to the initiation of NZVI field studies about a decade ago. A key point here: without well-characterized site conditions, pursuit of an in-situ clinical technology like ZVI would be foolhardy. Prior to consenting to the field demonstration, several meetings with our case team at the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection were required, as well as the submittal of a detailed work plan documenting the pros, the cons, and the expected outcomes of the injection process. This educational effort consumed about 6 months, but was an essential step in the process. a permit by rule was then issued by DEP, and we were off to the races. Next slide, please. This should be slide number 35. With respect to the objectives, we knew that DVI was worked well in the lab against a very broad array of environmental contaminants, but would it work in the field? What degradation-related intermediates or products might become an issue? Would the iron travel sufficiently well in the subsurface to be a practical remediation tool? We knew that there were theoretical synergies associated with ZVI, enhancing the natural attenuation of TCE in groundwater, but would we be able to see the effects of this in the field? Finally, we wanted to evaluate whether or not the results from this testing would indicate that NZVI, when commercially available, could be an element of the overall site remediation strategy. Next slide, please.
Hello?
This should be slide number 36. NZVI fieldwork has been conducted at two different areas of the site. The DTC 15 area is downgrading in the manufacturing building and includes monitoring wells DTC 15, DTC 12, and then MW 18. The second area, denoted area of concern 3, lies just upgrading of the manufacturing building near the location of a former 5,000-gallon TCE above-ground storage tank that was formerly used to supply the facility's vapor degreasers. Vapor degreasing operations ceased at the site by the mid-1990s, and multiple interim remediation measures, including the removal of this tank, transfer line, and the removal of DNAPL-impacted soils, were completed by the late 1990s. The area of concern 3 area includes monitoring wells DGC 9, DGC 9D, which span the entire shallow impacted aquifer, as well as MW 28, a monitoring well that is situated just inside the building. Next slide, please. This slide, number 37, shows an aerial image of what I was just talking about. AOC 3, the upgraded source area, lies just to the right of the picture, and the DGC 15 area, downgradient of the manufacturing building, lies to the left. Groundwater flow is generally to the west-northwest, as indicated by the dark blue arrow. You'll notice a roadway which lies just beyond the downgradient property boundary and an open, largely grassy area beyond. The latter is another former manufacturing site, which has also been undergoing extensive remedial activities. Next slide, please. Three NZVI injection events have been conducted at the site to date over the past 10 years. The initial study in 2000 involved a small scale, about a kilo worth of injections at the DGC 15 area to essentially serve as a proof of concept. In 2003, about a 25 kilo larger scale injection of supported nanoscale zero-valent iron was also injected in the same area to better develop the injection technique and increase the delivery mass of iron. In 2007, a larger scale 225 kilo injection of surface modified iron was conducted in the AOC 3 area to evaluate the reactivity of surface modified iron and assess its relative mobility, particularly whether it would be able to move underneath the building. Next slide, please. Everybody should be looking at slide number 39. Regarding the pre-injection conditions, I mentioned previously that the site is well characterized. Based on the aerial distribution of a 40-well monitoring network and many rounds of groundwater sampling since over the last 20 years. The impacted shallow aquifer is quite permeable and extends generally from a depth of 6 to 7 feet below ground surface to around 35 feet below ground surface, or BGS. The hydraulic gradient was pretty flat, and groundwater dissolved oxygen concentrations were quite low, generally less than 2 milligrams per liter across the site. ORP readings were typically on the order of plus 200 millivolts, and pH values were generally less than 5.5 standard pH units. Finally, TCE concentrations were on the order of about 600 parts per billion or less, with evidence in both NZVI test areas that natural attenuation was occurring. Next slide, please. This should be slide number 40. This slide shows a schematic of the monitoring infrastructure associated with the DGC 15 area. EGC-15 was the injection well for the dilute NZVI slurry, about 1 gram per liter. And then there are 3 downgradient piezometer couplets at 5-foot intervals that span the shallow aquifer to monitor the injected iron mass and as well as the impacts on contaminants within this small test area. Each of the piezometer couplets were denoted with an S or a D to denote their relative depth within the shallow aquifer. A recirculation loop was also established between PZ3S and DGC-15 to help increase the movement of the iron within the test area. Next slide, please. This should be slide number 41. This photograph shows the typical infrastructure with the small-scale DGC-15 injections. You can see two 165-liter storage tanks, pumps, valves, and tubing. Similar equipment might be used in the treatment of limited hotspot areas using a well-based injection approach. Professor Wei-Hsien and Zhang of Lehigh is shown at left in this photo, and contrary to what my colleague Dr. Paul Bardos may believe, this crew is actually working pretty hard to get the initial injection underway and the iron in the ground. Next slide, please. Everybody should be looking at slide number 42. This slide shows some of the data from the initial 1 gram per liter injection at two to three, 9, and 23 days following injection. Predictably, TCE concentrations decline most significantly at the monitoring locations closest to the point of injection. The contaminant reductions were temporary as the mass of iron was small and the injection was situated within an extensive plume with impacted groundwater constantly flowing into the test area. Interestingly, the data from the deeper D-series piezometers typically showed greater reductions over time, which can be explained by the relatively heavy injected iron slurry tending to sink with distance. This proof of concept study demonstrated that ZVI slurries could be injected under gravity feed conditions and the TCE reductions could be achieved. In addition to the TCE reductions, we did see evidence of increased concentrations of reduced hydrocarbon gases, particularly methane, ethene, and ethane during the course of the study. Now, slide number 43. This slide outlines the strategy used to inject the 225 kilos of surface-modified NZVI in AOC-3 in 2007. In this larger scale test, 2 different injection methods were used. One featured 2 injection wells, INJ1 and INJ2, which were installed to deliver the iron slurry, but significant well overflow issues believed to be associated with a lower permeability zone at 8 to 12 feet BGS caused us to abandon using the injection wells and inject the remaining 140 kilos using direct push geoprobe technology. The iron used in this large scale study was surface modified by sodium polymethacrylate, and the working injection concentration was about 20 grams per liter, far higher than what was done in the previous rounds of injections. 2 transects of geoprobe borings were used in this large-scale study, with injection occurring at 3 depth intervals, with each boring receiving approximately 20 to 25 pounds of iron. Next slide, please. This is slide number 44. This slide shows some of the equipment used in the 2007 NZVI injection campaign. The large black tank in the photo to the right was used to store formation water from injection well number 1. This water was used to dilute the concentrated NZVI slurry from about 700 grams per liter to the working concentration of 20 grams per liter. The iron slurry was then pumped from the 265-gallon 165-liter tanks shown in the foreground into the appropriate depth interval, starting with the deepest intervals and then moving up. Next slide. This should be slide number 45. The results from this work showed the expected pH and ORP changes. Although the extent of the ORP drop was not as great, we only saw about minus 300 millivolts as compared to previous injections where we typically saw minus 400 to even case, in some cases minus 500 millivolts. The roughly 35% TCE reduction after 6 months was also less than expected. However, a key highlight of the work was the observation that the injected sodium PMA modified iron traveled about 30 feet down gradient based on an inspection of soil cores from borings inside the building. We do speculate that the dose of sodium PMA may have been on the high side, potentially impacting the reactivity of the iron. So this is still clearly an evolving science. Next slide, please.
Just a note, you have approximately 5 minutes left in your time slot.
Okay, thank you. This slide, number 46, shows the groundwater quality data from August 2010 of the two different treatment areas of the site. The contaminant concentrations represent average values amongst the wells there. In general, the long-term results are quite encouraging. TCE is down about 45 to 60%, cis-TCE down between 15 and 33%. However, the data interpretation is not as straightforward since the declines observed are almost certainly composite of NZVI-mediated degradation as well as anaerobic natural attenuation. Distinguishing these processes in the field can be challenging and expensive. Next slide, please. I'm just going to quickly cover the next couple of slides since I'm running out of time. Should be looking at slide number 47. Based on the fieldwork at Trenton, I think a number of important technology implications and issues come to mind. Those shown in yellow font will be discussed further in the remaining slides. Number one, multiple injections of NZVI will invariably be required to meet the remediation objectives. The process of determining actual cost to cure is still not well developed. There remains a lack of quality assurance, quality control data for the iron. Potential exposure issues remain a concern, as well as regulatory acceptance, which may vary from state to state and from country to country. And then finally is the big issue, NZVI fate and transport considerations. Next slide, please. You should be looking at slide number 48. When purchasing NZVI for a project, typically one receives the iron in an MSDS, which can be very helpful from a safety standpoint or responding to spills, but it doesn't provide you very useful information regarding how effective the iron might perform. So there are a number of fundamental questions. How active is the iron? Let me just go to the next slide so I can just try to deal with this. Slide number 49. Slide number 49 shows a listing of the potential QA/QC parameters that I think need to be considered by potential users of the technology. The date that the iron was manufactured, a pHORP profile, since it can convey a sense of the water chemistry changes that might be elicited, particle size distribution, specific surface area, zeta potential, which is a measure of the surface potential and relative stability, isoelectric point, which is the pH at which the net surface charge is zero, and a batch reactivity test, using a fixed concentration of a standard reductase like TCE to assess the relative reactivity of the iron over a fixed time frame. This is the kind of information that potential users are going to want to know in advance before they inject the iron in the field. Slide number 50. This slide just is a cartoon that kind of shows what happens to the iron once it's in the field. Essentially, the zero-valent iron core shrinks over time. It develops an oxide shell of various iron-based minerals, and then the iron is over time removed from the aquifer by interactions with the aquifer media. I think that the actual duration of activity in the field are going to depend on a wide variety of site-specific conditions in the solution, but recent studies suggest that it could be on the order of several months or more. Next slide, number 51. This just shows some of the take-home key points. Performance versus cost. Do you need the extra reactivity of NZVI in light of its cost, the attendant handling challenges, and the likelihood of multiple injections being required? Delivery issues. make sure that the area to be treated is well characterized, the hydrogeology is reasonable, and that the injection approach is appropriate for the site conditions. Number three, interpreting the site data can be challenging for contaminants like the chloroethenes, where overlapping abiotic and biotic degradation tends to occur. Finally, proximity of receptors is a very important consideration. This technology may not be appropriate to defend a property boundary like a permeable reactive barrier might, and as well, the formation of reduced gases or lesser chlorinated intermediates, as might be the case for the chloromethanes, could elevate vapor intrusion risk near buildings. Next slide, please. This is slide number 52. Finally, I think that NZVI is a useful complementary remedial technology. One major hurdle limiting the growth over the last 15 years is a general lack of robust cost-effectiveness data. And finally, I think that the environmental state of injected NZVI is likely a lesser concern as compared to worker exposure for those involved in actually manufacturing the material. Moving to slide number 53, and I appreciate it. I apologize for kind of rushing the end, but as always, I have too much material and not enough time. Thank you.
No problem. Thank you so very much. I'm going to, final reminder, please place your phone on mute. You heard a couple of sneezes come across the line there, so again, it's *6 to mute your telephone line, please. I'm going to take one question, then we'll move on to the very next speaker. And this question comes in from West Deptford, New Jersey. And they ask, do you have any insight regarding the downgradient distance from a ZVI injection application point where enhanced anaerobic conditions are still observed, i.e. low EH? Typically, how far do the effects of ZVI reach downgradient?
Well, they clearly will extend as far as the iron will move, but we see the water chemistry changes dramatically lowered ORP and modulated pH for in some cases 50, 100 feet down gradient from the point of injection. Again, it's going to depend on the size of the iron injection, the velocity of groundwater flow, but it should be tens of feet beyond the point of injection, very, very conservatively.
Okay, great. Thank you. And again, we are getting all those questions that you're submitting electronically. Don't worry, we will get to them. We're just limiting right now so we can move along with the agenda. So, Marty, if you'd like to introduce the next speaker.
Okay, thank you, Jean. Our next speaker is Dr. Peter Kvapil. I'm sorry if I mispronounced your name, Peter. He is with AquaTest, and Dr. Kvapil will tell us about some case studies in the European Union.
And this is starting on slide number 54. Peter, you can take yourself off of mute, hitting *6.
It's done, I hope.
Yes, you're good. Thank you very much.
Okay. So thank you, Matti, and good morning, afternoon, and evening to everybody. And let me talk more about our experiences with nanoiron technology from Europe. So let's go to the next slide, slide number 55. So what are my presentation objectives? It's to start a discussion. But looking to the number of participants, I would not tell to start a discussion, but to continue a discussion about major nanoiron topics and problems which are discussed now. This is a risk management problem being addressed as a practical delivery and the use of the technology. What is the regulatory approval process, and of course results and monitoring, and of course also risk versus benefits of this technology. Let's go to the next slide, number 56. The history of nanoiron technology in Czech Republic, and here I would like to say that it's also in Europe, because our first application was done in 2004, and it was one of first applications performed in Europe, which we've done together with Golder Associates. In this time, nobody knew how does it work, and nobody here had experience with this technology. It was done in the Spolkemia site, the first pilot test, and even that If you can see the graph, we had quite good reduction of chlorinated hydrocarbons at the field. But anyway, I think that the leak of knowledge of this technology led to the fact that this technology was not an appropriate technology for the full scale remediation of this site in this time. And you will see at the end of this presentation that recently we have started the injection of nanoiron in the full scale at this site. So we needed, let's say, 6 years more to come here. So let's go to the next slide, slide number 57. Gurivodi site was the first successful pilot test done here in Czech Republic. It was in a fractured bedrock. We did a lot of characterization work before the application, and I think this is very important to do the characterization before you apply the nanoiron into the soil. You can see in the graph that we started in 20 milligrams per liter, and we went within several time up to several tens of micrograms per liter. I think that this result was big motivation for us and for everybody to go further with this technology. But anyway, this technology was not also applied for full-scale remediation at this site. Let's go to the next slide, number 58. This is a list of all pilot and also full-scale application done within the years we have been working with this technology. You can see that from the year 2008, we have already three sites running in full scale. And if you look on highlighted cases, these are cases which I'm going to present here in this seminar. But the objective here is not to present all the data about from that cases, but more to discuss the decision process why this nanoiron was used for the full scale. Let's go to the next slide, 59. Steps to the full scale. So first, we start with the feasibility approval in laboratory. Then, very important point is regulatory approval process. Then, it's necessary to test the technology. We have all agreement from authorities. It's necessary to test it at the field, and if all that phases or steps were successful, we can go to the full scale. Next slide, number 60. Feasibility laboratory tests. I'm going to talk to you about, to tell you about our procedure, but I think that everybody of you has own procedure, how to do laboratory tests. The thing is that we have almost not changed our system or our methodology since the beginning, so we have quite a lot of data which are comparable. We are doing mostly the preparation in the form of a batch test in the system of nanoparticles, water and soil. We are doing it in two phases. First, verification of efficient concentration test. This is a graph below, the result of concentration test, and the second phase is verification of reaction rate. It's a kinetic test. Next slide, number 61. Nanoiron project regulations here. Here, the injection of any chemical to the subsoil system is regulated by water law. Usually we need the exception for irregular matters injection into the subsoil, and not everywhere is needed this exception. It's usually the subject of decision of regional authorities. They require often a field pilot test before they are giving us the agreement. But usually here the iron technology is much more easily accepted than the technology based on other soluble materials like some kind of oxidants or reductants. Next slide, please. Field system from the 2009, I think this is the system which has changed really a lot from the beginning. The major part of the field system is a dosing system to which goes the water, which is pre-treated by a filter where we are removing an oxygen and contaminant if it's necessary. And we bring to the site fresh, dry iron powder, and we are producing a slurry directly at the site, which brings big advantage to have a fresh product with a lot of big content of zero violent iron, and which brings an advantage to have a control about the mobility and reactivity by the formulation of iron directly at the site, specific to the local conditions. Let's go to the next slide. First case is PCB case study. I'm going to talk about this case because the iron is appropriate technology compared to other in-situ techniques, because here we need really reactive material compared to other iron materials, bigger size iron materials. Only nano size is efficient for removal of PCBs, and this is the reason why nano iron has been tested at this site. Next slide shows results of laboratory tests. We have done many, many tests with the reduction of PCBs with the nano iron, with several different nano iron materials. You can see from the graph below that different nano iron materials gives almost the same result. The only thing, and this is the question until now for us, is why we are not able to remove all PCBs or 100% PCBs from the water sample, and this doesn't depend on the concentration of the dose iron. Let's go to the next slide. This is a picture from the field. The white circle in the middle between wells is a pumping well, and wells around are application wells where nano iron was injected. If you see on the graph, you can see that we've been removed, let's say, 50-60% of contamination, what is in good relation with our laboratory results. Let's go to the next slide. It is a second case which has not been performed by AquaTest, but we were participating on discussion on that case. Here, the decision for the use of nano iron was a decision of the client. We had a comparable test with reduction by enhancing with the lactate biodegradation of chlorinated hydrocarbons at this site. The decision was done because there was bioproducts of reduction produced during the lactate reduction nor during the nano iron injection. So that was a major decision done why to use nano iron at this site. Here you can see plume shapes, and next slide, number 67. Here you can see shapes of plume and the system of nano iron injection points, which were nano iron was injected into 82 direct push wells, and in two stages, 600 kilograms of nano iron was injected. Let's go to the next slide. It is a detail from one plume. You can see a decrease of concentration of PCE in time. Let's look on the next slide where are described concentration of, let's say, slowest degradable compound, what is DCE. You can see that DCE was not formed at this site, and you can see even within 9 months quite high decrease of DCE concentration. Let's go to the next slide. The total cost of this project was €300,000. Slide number 71. Písečná site is a site where AquaTest is doing nano iron remediation together with Geogroup company. Here it is fractured bedrock area. The decision why to use nano iron here was first looking for high reactivity material because of presence of chlorinated ethanes together with chlorinated ethenes. And the second argument was a drinking water sources in the neighborhood, so something what is what has high solubility is not suitable for this site. Let's go to the next slide. Also, many different laboratory tests we have performed with different nano iron materials. We have studied aggregation, sedimentation, mobility, and reactivity. And if we go to the next slide, you can see results from column tests of different nano iron materials. You can see that the Toda iron is very well mobile, has well penetrated all columns of tested soil. Let's go to the next slide. It is the result of reactivity test. Here is evident the fact that the type of iron which has not been modified, surface modified, has the highest reactivity. And it is the green line showing that there was the best result of reactivity of nano iron, of this nano iron type. Let's go to the next slide, number 75. This is a result from a field pilot test application. We have done two tests at the same site, but different locations. We have expected that locations will give the same conditions, but the conditions were not equal in the fractured bedrock area. It is very difficult to find equal parts of the site. But anyway, we have observed some results between two tested irons. Both irons give almost the same result. From the point of view of chloroethenes, but some differences were observed in concentrations of chloroethanes. Let's go to the next slide. This is what I've been telling you in the precedent slide, talking about field technological system. So it was done exactly like this. So pretreatment of technological water, preparation of slurry from the fresh dry nano iron powder, and semi-automatic dosing system. Let's go to the next slide where you can see pictures how those technological units looks like. So on the upper left corner you can see unit for formation of a slurry. From this, the slurry goes to the right, to the dosing system and the filter for the water pretreatment, and then it goes to 30 application wells at this site. In the left bottom corner, you can see how the dry iron powder has been stored in the metallic bottles. Let's go to the next slide, slide number 78. This is a result of first full-scale application at this site, which has been done last year. This year has been done another application. The result after first injection, full-scale injection, was that we decreased the concentrations of chlorinated hydrocarbons in the order of, let's say, 40-50% average. Let's go to the next slide, number 79. Here I have listed major parameters and the total cost of this project, which was €360,000. Let's go to the next slide. It's a slide, a historical slide from Spokemia, which I've been talking within my first slide. Here nano iron has been chosen to remediate a part of plume around this building. This building has an exploited cellars, and the use of other technology could harm the quality of cellars which are not well insulated against the groundwater, and here the existence of or the presence of vinylchloride, for example, could be not safe around this building. So here we have projected nano iron, which has been done also in the stages or in steps laboratory field pilot test. This is the indication of field pilot test. And if you go to the next slide, number 81, you can see results of pilot test contaminations here. Our contamination here is formed by chlorinated methanes and chlorinated ethenes. You can see that chlorinated methanes are better degradable than chlorinated ethenes. Let's go to the next slide. This is
here you have about 4 minutes left.
Okay. Thank you. This is a picture of a full-scale application to direct push wells. We are injecting to 5 wells in one time, and then we move to another location. Let's go to the next slide. This is an interesting case to the end, which I'm going to present you. It's a use of nano iron to catalyze another technologies or to enhance another technologies. Here I'm going to talk about combination of bio reduction process and the chemical reduction process with the nano iron. We have set up 3 tests in 3 different locations. In one well, we have injected lactic acid in 2 phases, and in second 2 wells, we have injected lactate and nano iron, but in one well, first nano iron and then lactic acid, and in the second well, the opposite. Let's go to the next slide to see how looks like the result of long-term monitoring. So the red line is a pure lactate injection. It's normal that the concentration is rising because lactate has a function of dissolving chemical. So we are solubilizing some parts of contamination, but you cannot see it here. But it exists that during this rising of concentration, there is big change in contaminant composition. So tetrachloroethylene, which was there initially, is disappearing, and we are looking here almost 100% of cis dichloroethylene. On the other hand, the combination of lactate followed by nano iron seems to be fruitful. In the beginning, it is almost the same like pure nano iron injection, but in one moment it's starting to decrease rapidly, and it's right that we don't have yet the final explanation of this, but what I think about it, it's a function of iron reductive bacteria, which are helping to keep nano iron in good state. Let's go to the next slide, the last slide of my presentation, perspective of nano iron. So we've been seeing several different cases and several different reasons why to use nano iron for remediation. So first reason is to use nano iron because of its high reactivity, because some pollutants need high reactivity material to be reduced. Another argument for using nano iron is to use it for sites where the presence of toxic intermediates can be hazardous, what is buildings and cellars. The same is the fact that in the proximity of used cellars or underground facilities, we change the quality of water, which can smell bad, for example. Here, nano iron with its quite low mobility can bring an advantage. Another reason where to use nano iron is in the proximity of water sources. Nano iron is not much soluble and is not much mobile, and other substances which are well soluble and well mobile could harm the quality of water sources. And the last reason can be to enhance remediation processes started by another technologies. Let's go to the next slide. I would like to thank to everybody for an attention and if they have some questions.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. I'm going to switch over to the telephone lines and see if we have a question that's come in by phone. If you're on the phone lines, you can press #6 and take yourself off of mute to ask a question to Peter directly. Any questions on the phones?
No.
Okay. All right. Well, then in the interest of time, I think we'll move on to the very next speaker. Thank you so much for keeping us on with our agenda. Marty?
Okay. Thank you, Jean. And thank you, Peter. Our next speaker is Michael Borda. He's with Golder Associates. And Dr. Borda will discuss field applications in the U.S. and abroad.
Thanks, Marty.
Great. Sorry, we're just a reminder, we're starting on slide number 87.
Thanks. Yeah, first of all, I want to thank the organizers, US EPA and Claire, for the opportunity to present, and also just want to thank my fellow instructors. It's always nice to get together with some of the folks doing iron remediation. Much like Dan and Peter, I got to try and present about 10 years of experience that Golder has had in 20 minutes. So I'm either going to have to talk really fast or I'm going to spare you guys some of the gory details of 10 years of iron injections. But ultimately, my goal really is to discuss Golder's experience implementing NZVI technology at sites in the U.S., in Canada, and in Europe. And hopefully I can present it to you in the context of several things. One is, you know, how did these field scale implementations, how did they really scale up from lab bench studies that were performed? And then, in some cases, how did pilot scale field studies actually scale up to the full scale? I also try to touch on a bit of the particle fate and transport issues that go along with trying to inject particles into the ground. And finally, try to give you a flavor of some of the regulatory concerns and issues that come up during these implementations. So we'll advance to the next slide, slide 88. The key things I want to talk about today, I'll start off with giving you sort of the summary of the keys that we've found through our global NZVI experience at Golder to success for trying to implement this technology. I'll talk to you a little bit about creating a positive global perception of the technology. And what I really mean there is both from Golder's standpoint, but also from the standpoint of the community of people implementing nanoscale zero-valent iron, we really do have a responsibility to create a positive perception of the technology to stakeholders. And those stakeholders include regulatory agencies, the public, our clients. And I think I'll show you how I think that has to be done by dispelling some of the mythology that started in the early days of using nanoscale zero-valent iron and really starting to talk about, you know, what this technology can and, in fact, cannot do. I'll also talk about one brief slide on the global academic network that we've really been working with in order to advance some of the research and development in this technology. Briefly summarize the 10 years of experience we've had in a number of projects, and then focus in on some case studies, one from the United States and one from Canada. And then also talk a little bit about research and development activities that are going on in Germany. And finally, talk a little bit about some of the regulatory status in the UK. And that'll really be more of an introduction to the speakers that will follow me, Paul Bardos and John Henstock. So next slide will be slide 89. So over the 10 years that we've been working with nanoscale iron at Golder, we've really come to find there's a few keys to success. And in fact, these keys to success are actually pretty similar for any in situ technology. It's really not that specific to iron. It really stems from a foundation of a very well-developed conceptual site model. And what I mean by that is you really need to understand the geology. You need to understand the hydrogeology of your site, the chemistry of the contaminants of concern that you're trying to degrade. You need to understand the geochemical environment in which they exist. And when you put all those things together, it gives you the opportunity to really screen in or screen out a technology such as nanoscale zero-valent iron. Once you actually can come to the conclusion that NDVI may work at a site, the next decisions and the keys that we found are the choice of your ZVI material. And I use ZVI specifically here because in some cases it may not be appropriate or necessary to use a nanoscale form. And I'll talk a little bit more about whether or not we've ever used a nanoscale form in a few slides. Along with that, there's also some questions about the additive selection. There's been a number of mentions in the talks about different surface modifiers. And so the choice of what you're going to use, in some cases we've used things like soy protein, others have used polyacrylamate. There's tons of different things that people have used, so you have to make those decisions. Of course, regulatory acceptance becomes a major player. For example, in the UK right now, it's prohibited the use of nanoscale material, so that will seriously impact doing NDVI work. Reactivity is obviously a concern. But in fact, really, it's a balance of reactivity and treatment longevity that we found is really critical. And what I mean by that is you can make incredibly small nanoparticles that are incredibly reactive. And they're so reactive that the half-life of their actual treatment is so short that they really aren't useful in doing any kind of remediation. So part of really understanding the reactivity of particles and the longevity is, again, striking that balance. And finally, the key thing in this technology is deliverability. I mean, we've all had experience with bench-scale work. The key here, I think, is if you do bench-scale studies with NDVI, the chemistry works. We understand the chemistry of a zero-valent iron, that it can very well degrade chlorinated compounds. That's not the question. The question really becomes what happens when you try to put this stuff in the ground and actually target the contaminants where they exist. And that's where the problems come, because ultimately, with a well-developed conceptual site model, you're still not treating, a jar full of soil, and you're not able to well mix it, and you're not able to see the kind of efficiency that we can see at the bench scale. So there are some serious issues with deliverability. We'll move on to the next slide, which is slide 90. And this is really speaking to managing some of the expectations that are out there about this technology. I've presented this slide before. I still present it. I think it's still useful because I'm not sure that all of the sort of myths have been completely lost out there in the NDVI game. The first thing, was really when NDVI came onto the scene, the concept was that, this was really going to change the way remediation was done. When you looked at bench scale results, we were seeing 100% dechlorination in hours. That came from bench scale testing, as I mentioned before, well mixed, incredibly good contact of the contaminant with the surface of the NDVI particle, which is critical for reactivity. The reality is that's not what you see in the field. We can't get well mixed systems that same way. We can't achieve that kind of contact. And the reality is when we compiled the results from a number of sites that we've had, over 20 of them, it's probably, 60 to 80% type dechlorination in a year, and I would even venture to say it's less than that. It's probably more in the 50%. And then the question becomes, how much of that is abiotic reactivity from direct contact with NDVI, and how much of that is actually enhanced bioremediation that occurs as a result of the changes in the geochemistry that NDVI can cause? The second one is, when this technology first came out, the concept was really that you could inject NDVI in the groundwater, it would travel along with the groundwater because they're very small particles and effectively treat an entire plume with injections. Certainly that is not the reality. We've spent the better part of the 10 years working on this just trying to get NDVI to move very small distances in unconsolidated materials. And the reasons that becomes very difficult are things like the agglomeration of particles with one another, settling out of the groundwater once the flow field is reduced. So if you're doing pressure injections, as long as you're applying pressure to the injections, you can keep the particles moving. As soon as you stop, most times they're gonna settle right out. And then interactions with the actual material and the aquifer. I mean, there's charge issues, magnetic issues, a lot of reasons that these particles don't actually travel indefinitely with groundwater. And finally, the other kind of fiction is that NDVI is a true nanomaterial. Now, I'm not speaking here for every nanoscale iron that's out there, but I can say this with certainty for the materials that Golder has used. We've never really used a true nanomaterial. There's some very specific definitions for nanomaterials, and in fact, Marty touched on those in the beginning, that really the definition of something being a nanomaterial is that it represents unique electronic properties when you compare the material to its bulk counterpart. So in this case, it would be to bulk zero valent iron of a larger size. And really, the kind of transition that you see where unique electronic properties start to occur is probably less than 10 nanometers for particles. We've injected predominantly particles that were milled to a size of 50 nanometers to maybe 100 nanometers. And in fact, immediately after you produce those kind of size materials, agglomeration starts to occur, and the ultimate particles that are injected are probably larger than even that. So one of the biggest issues is that, you know, no matter how you cut it, at least from Golder's standpoint, we really haven't been using nanomaterials. We are using small materials, and in fact, we get an increase in reactivity because of an increase in the reactive surface area. But a true nanomaterial is not something we've really worked with. We'll move on to slide 91. In this slide, I'm not going to go through the different academic institutions, but I just want to make the point that, you know, Golder has not been going about this research alone. We've worked with a number of universities around the globe, and it's really through those relationships that we've been able to work on a number of different research and development projects, and I'll highlight one of those that's going on in Germany currently. And we've also been able to do quite a bit of toxicity testing to try to understand the materials that we're actually injecting and what kind of toxicological effects that they actually have. The next slide, which is slide 92, is actually the background of the slide is a table showing a summary of all the Golder projects that have been implemented to date. There's on this slide specifically, there's 21 different sites that NDVI has been implemented. Peter's sites from the Czech Republic that Golder worked with Aquatest are included in those. But I just wanted to break it down a little bit by sort of the numbers to give you a sense of what was going on, because there's no way to go through all these different locations. But ultimately, we've done 23 different locations worldwide. Just to break that down for you, 14 of those have been in the U.S., 6 have been in Europe, 2 in Canada, and 1 in the Caribbean. Just to give you an idea of the kind of contaminants that we're dealing with, 19 of those sites were chlorinated ethene sites. 2 of them had PCBs. 1 of them had chlorinated methanes and ethanes, chlorinated ethanes. And 1 of them was a chromium site. And that really is a depiction of the main chemical of concern. Just to give you a little bit of a breakdown of the different NDVI type materials that were used, about 80% of the sites we used a mechanically crushed zero valent iron, so iron that was produced from a top-down approach using a larger stock iron and mechanically crushing it to approximately 50 to 100 nanometers. About 20% of those sites were performed using a wellhead precipitated NDVI, so a zero valent iron that was made directly through precipitation at the wellhead. And then one of the sites was actually a laboratory precipitated, and that was the first site that was done in 2002 in North Carolina. So we'll move on to the next slide. And what I'm going to do now is really focus in a little bit more on some of the case studies to give you a little bit better sense of the kind of implementations that we've done, and hopefully I can present those in light of those keys to success that I presented earlier, and also touch on some of the issues that went with these implementations. So the first site that I'll talk about was a site in the U.S. Golder Associates did the work at a bedrock NDVI injection using hydraulic fracturing at a site in North Carolina. So to summarize, really based on those keys, this was a site where there was, in fact, a very well-developed conceptual site model. What we had at this site were chlorinated VOCs in a fractured bedrock system. There was a very heterogeneous distribution of hydraulic conductivities in that bedrock. And why that becomes important is because you've got areas that are very difficult to inject in, some areas that may be easier to inject in, and we needed to develop a technique there that we could start to actually connect those different areas, and that's where the use of hydraulic fracturing comes in. The material that we chose to use at this site was a Golder NZVI. That's a mechanically crushed material. That material was doped with palladium, so it was in fact a bimetallic nanomaterial. And we also chose to use soy protein as a dispersant. From a reactivity standpoint, a treatability standpoint, we did see significant treatment of the CVOCs from concentrations that were above 160,000 parts per billion down to less than 20,000 parts per billion, although I have to say that this test itself was not really designed to look at reactivity. It was really designed to look at deliverability. And in fact, from the deliverability standpoint, what we were after was trying to understand whether we could do hydraulic fracturing prior to injection of nanoscale iron to, in fact, connect these areas where we knew had low hydraulic conductivity to areas outside of that zone that would have higher hydraulic conductivity. And what I can show you with the pictures on the right, this was a very interesting result that we achieved. In the top left picture, which is labeled BNP1, that was the injection well. What these photographs are showing is water that was removed during development for a groundwater sampling event 3 months after the injection of NZVI in these wells. So BNP1 was the injection well. BNP5 was a well that was 50 feet away. That's on the bottom left. It was 50 feet away. It was actually down hydraulically up gradient, and it actually was in a zone of very low hydraulic conductivity, an area that we did not think we would see much impact. But as you can see from water being removed from that well 3 months later, there is some brown tint to the water. There was a high total iron content to the water, suggesting that we did in fact get some iron to that location. Well BNP4, which is the top right corner, was 60 feet down gradient of the injection well. And as you can see from the water coming out during the development 3 months later, we had a significant amount of iron that was able to get to that location. And then BNP2, on the bottom right, 100 feet away, we were also able to observe iron in the development water during the sampling. So effectively, what we were able to do was use hydraulic fracturing to connect some of these different areas of hydraulic conductivity that we knew and distribute iron at least to a distance of 100 feet. As far as treatment longevity goes, in this case, we really didn't evaluate that. The testing program, the sampling program was not significantly long-term because what we were most after was the deliverability. But what was an interesting, I think the interesting thing from a regulatory side was that in this case, in North Carolina, we had a significant amount of support from the state regulatory agency, very supportive, helpful with the process. And actually, I can say that in general in the U.S., what we found is that from the permitting standpoint, where underground injection control permits or the like are necessary, they've been relatively straightforward. And in fact, we found from both federal and state regulatory agencies that it's typically been a very helpful and supportive process in going through getting NZVI permitted. And in fact, we've really seen that the agencies have worked well with us and really developed a clear path forward for getting this authorized. So move on to the next slide, which is 95. And this is describe a case study that we performed, an injection in Canada. So Golder Associates did an injection of NZVI in a permeable unconsolidated sediments in Quebec, Canada. Move on to slide 96. And again, giving you the backdrop, a well-developed conceptual site model was again already performed on this site. We had chlorinated VOCs in a very high transmissivity glacial outwash sand aquifer. In the sense of looking for a site, this would be probably the best case scenario for injecting nanoscale iron. It's a very high transmissivity aquifer. It should have worked wonderfully. But it also, this site gave us the opportunity to understand about continuously refining the conceptual site model as during the injections, we started to see that some areas of influence, we weren't actually getting degradation in some of the deeper wells. And what we ended up finding out during the course of the injections was that there was a silty clay lens that was at depth that was actually keeping iron from getting down into the deeper part of some of the wells. And what we were able to do in that case was use in-well recirculation to actually distribute iron below the silty clay lens, and we were able to get significantly better treatment. In this case, the material that we chose was, again, Golder MZVI, the mechanically crushed material, and it was dispersed with soy protein. From a regulatory standpoint, we didn't have any issues really with using nanoscale iron in Canada, but one of the things that became a bit of an issue was the original choice for a dispersant was polyacrylic acid. The Ministry of the Environment in Canada had an issue with that. We went through a fairly lengthy process of getting polyacrylic acid approved. In fact, in the end, we did get it approved, but by the time we got to that point, we had already done a significant amount of research on using soy protein and found that it was an acceptable alternative, and so we instead chose to use soy protein. From a reactivity standpoint, again, we saw pretty significant CVOC treatment, TCE concentrations from greater than 400 parts per billion to below 5 parts per billion, which was, in this case, the performance criteria for the pilot test. So we were able to achieve and sustain that performance criteria. From the deliverability standpoint, we used pressurized injections. We didn't do any kind of fracturing. This was in unconsolidated sand. But as I mentioned before, we did have to initiate some groundwater recirculation in order to deliver the iron to below the silty clay lens that existed at depth. What was really an important finding in the study from Canada was the treatment longevity. The expectation going in was that we would do injections, monitor it for probably on the order of 6 months. We anticipated that at 6 months we would see a significant decrease in the reactivity, in the production of degraded daughter products, and that would probably be the end of monitoring. When in fact, what we ended up doing was monitoring the system for more than 2 years, and we saw continued treatment for that entire period. What was fairly interesting about the continued treatment was a change that occurred after approximately 5 to 6 months, and that's what's shown in the graph to the right. I recognize you can't really read the axes or anything, but what you're seeing here is actually the concentration of cis-1,2-chloroethane on the y-axis and time on the x. And basically what we saw was after approximately 5 months, we saw a conversion of the type of products that were being formed. In the early stages before that 5 month change, what we saw was a decrease in TCE without the subsequent increase in cis-1,2-DCE or vinyl chloride. We were seeing what I think could be best described as the beta elimination type reactions where the products were probably acetylene type compounds. But after approximately 5 months, we saw this change where we started to see the more classical hydrogenolysis formation products like cis-1,2-DCE and vinyl chloride. Although we did not see significant production of vinyl chloride, we saw it actually going more straight to ethene. And what we think was going on in this situation was that early in the injection, because we used soy protein, we had significant total organic carbon concentrations, but after about 5 months, those concentrations dropped down to levels that were probably much more acceptable for more classical enhanced anaerobic bioremediation. Hydrogen concentrations likely came down at that point as well, and we think that what we're seeing there is a transition to truly enhanced anaerobic bioremediation.
Mike, just a note, you've got about 3 minutes left in the time slot.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. So we'll move on to the next slide, 97. And this is just a little introduction to a research and development project that's going on in Germany. It's between Golder Associates and the Helmholtz Center for Environmental Research. Move on to the next slide, which is 98. And the project is basically a lab investigation and a field application. It's financed currently through the German Federal Ministry of Research and Technology. It started in May of 2010, and it's going to last for about 3 years. Move on to the next slide, 99. And really, it's a new approach. It's developing a new material called carbo-iron. It's a composite material of nano-iron that's actually on a activated carbon substrate, an activated carbon microparticle. So These are submicron, about 800 nanometer activated carbon particles. The idea being activated carbon, we all know, is great for sorption. So we have a sorption barrier that will grab onto the contaminants, and then we dope that with some nano iron, which we know is quite reactive. And so what you effectively are left with is a sorption reaction barrier, or carbo-iron. Move on to the next slide, which is 100. As I mentioned, in the UK, Golder has been involved and continues to be involved with what's going on in the current regulatory area. And we'll move on to the next slide, which is 101. And really, the current UK status, I put this slide in and then realized I was going to be followed up by a presentation from Claire that would certainly touch on this, I'm sure. So I will just use this as an intro for John Henstock and Paul Pardos. But really, I guess the point from Golder's standpoint is that, you know, the current status has prohibited the use of NZVI. And hopefully we can be heavily involved with sharing our knowledge of how to implement and what some of the issues are with NZVI implementation and help to support the DEFRA project. We'll move on to the last slide, which is 102. So just want to kind of wrap it up with a little bit of Golder's perception of what's on the horizon for nanoscale zero-valent iron. Moving forward, I think there's certainly, if we're going to continue to use crushed type materials or the relatively small materials that have a high potential for agglomeration, we'll need to continue to use things like dispersants, and hopefully there will be some advances in finding even more green dispersants, more biodegradable, more easily acceptable to stakeholders for injection. Certainly, we want to continue doing research on toxicity and understanding the specific particles that we're using and what their impacts are in the environment. There will certainly be a significant amount of enhanced and deliverability as we look at new and different injection technologies like the use of hydraulic fracturing, pneumatic fracturing in both soils and in bedrock. There's very exciting research that's been going on for several years in Australia on the use of electrokinetics and using different technologies to move particles in the ground. And finally, there's certainly, as carbo-iron is an example, and there are many others, there are new iron materials, new particle sizes, new mixtures of particle sizes and materials that probably hold a lot of promise for where this technology can go to in the future. So just in closing, I think, you know, one of the things of dispelling the myth is that, you know, NZVI is truly not a remedial panacea. There's a very specific set of site conditions that are useful to look at whether NZVI can be used. It doesn't work everywhere, and you need to really understand those situations. And as a community of people implementing this technology, we really have to keep that in mind because it's still, as much as it has matured, it still, I think, hangs in the balance of people using it properly. And so I think ultimately, you know, our research and the research going on in NZVI and the implementation as a community, we have to continue to help alleviate the concerns that people have and base all that on sound science. So that is all for me, and I don't know if I have time for questions, but certainly we can discuss things at the end.
Thanks so much, Mike. I'm going to squeeze in one question here that came in online. This one comes in from the UK, and they ask, would you say that the mechanically crushed material is truly at the nanoscale, i.e. 100 nanometers or less, or is it a mix of the, quote, N and, quote, M ZVI? Perhaps this has some particular advantages in terms of reactivity and longevity.
I would say that the crushed material most likely has some fraction that is in that less than 100 nanometer scale. By and large, I think if you look at the distribution of particle sizes, they probably are around the 100 nanometer size, but that's immediately at production. Because you're mechanically crushing that material, effectively you're breaking bonds at the surface. You're creating very high surface free energy environment on those particles, and so they agglomerate very quickly to satisfy that energy issue. And so ultimately, I think the particle size, by the time we transport that material and then inject it, is probably almost always all above the 100 nanometer size.
Okay, great. Thank you so very much. Just a reminder, please keep your phone lines on mute by hitting *6. Marty, would you like to introduce our final speaker for today?
Yes, thanks, Jean. Our final speakers are Dr. John Henstock with Claire and Dr. Paul Bardos with R3 Environmental Technology Limited in the UK, and they will talk about initial views on the benefits versus the risks of the technology. And one thing, I should have mentioned this earlier on, that I'm not giving you the full biographies of each of our speakers. Those, there are write-ups available on the website for this seminar. So just in the interest of having more time for our presentations.
And with that, I would remind people on slide number 103.
Okay.
Paul and John, you can take yourselves off of mute by hitting *6 whenever you're ready.
Well, good morning, everybody. Good afternoon and good evening. This is Paul Bardos. I'm going to give the slides to avoid us having a kind of midway tango in the slide set. Before I begin, I would like to thank, on behalf of this CLARE project, the US EPA for organizing this webinar. Already it's been enormously useful to us. So I'd like to say on behalf of me and John that we're both very grateful for this webinar. So if we can move on to the next slide, which is slide 104. My talk is much briefer than the other talks. I'm going to introduce the project that we've been doing, which Michael's already mentioned. Then go through where we're seeing benefits in the use of iron nanoparticles, what we're seeing in terms of risks, and our provisional conclusions that we think we might be putting in our project report, which we hope will be the basis for some discussion. If you find our conclusions somewhat controversial, well then, frankly, I'm delighted, because that will mean that we'll have a good discussion after we've finished our talk. So if we can move on to the next slide, please, 105. Our project is funded by the UK's Department of Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, and that guides environmental policy in England. It also advises policy in Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland, but they have their own departments. This is a short literature-based review, and what we want to look at is a risk-benefit approach to the application of iron nanoparticles for the remediation of contaminated sites in the environment. We want to determine really whether it's time to reevaluate the recommendations for this precautionary approach that's been applied in the UK about the release of nanoparticles into the environment. One thing that I'd like to make clear at this point is that this paper from the Royal Society and the Royal Academy was about nanoparticles in general. It wasn't specifically about iron nanoparticles. One of the main outputs of our project, therefore, is going to be some kind of guidance or policy tool that we will offer to DEFRA. Our report is due to be with DEFRA in the spring of 2011. It will go into the public domain, but that will be after a publication process within the government, and I don't know exactly how long that will take, but hopefully it won't be too long. So if we can move to the next slide, please, slide 106. Claire is the coordinator of the project, but they've put together an international project team to deal with the project, and there's everybody's acknowledgement. Next slide, please, 107. Well, the benefits that we're seeing I guess, is this idea that you can extend the range of treatable contaminants by using the increased chemical functionality that you get at a nanoscale. So, for example, you can bring into the family of treatable contaminations things that were not previously thought to be degradable. There is a big gap between what's been demonstrated at a lab scale and what's been proven in the field, as the other speakers have already mentioned. Another benefit, I think, that we're seeing is the potential that this is a treatment that can be applied to the source term, right? In a pollutant linkage, you have a source, a pathway, and a receptor. Often, when you're looking at an in-situ treatment, you're really looking at pathway management interventions. There's a possible benefit, again, in some cases, that you could use nanoparticles as a source treatment because of the high reactivity of the intervention that you're putting in. However, in practice, the majority of iron nanoparticle applications in the field have also been for pathway management. There's also a benefit which is claimed, which I think can be a little contentious, and that's the effectiveness of the contaminant removal. So you'll often see an example in the literature about the fact that if you're degrading a chlorinated solvent like TCE with an in-situ anaerobic biodegradation, it can hang at a DCE stage, whereas it's claimed for the iron nanoparticles you don't get this hang and everything's degraded nicely to ethene. Like all things, this is not strictly true. The reason you might get a DCE hang in an in-situ biodegradation is generally related to site-specific conditions. It might be because you don't have a fully competent microbial community, and there are people selling inocula, which can address that. It might be because there's a particular problem with electron acceptors. Also, there's plenty of evidence that you don't necessarily get a complete contaminant removal for these chlorinated solvents for iron nanoparticle treatments as well. So, cut a long story short, we see a number of benefits for iron nanoparticles. They're often presented in a way that's quite generic, but in fact, these benefits are often site-specific or contaminant-specific, and really they're more niche. So we move on to the next slide, 108. Well, I've kind of already covered the first point. Another claim that we've seen is this idea that the iron nanoparticles are easy to use, easy to inject into aquifers, and travel along with the groundwater quite nicely. Whereas when we see papers of actual field-scale applications, we see plenty of examples where it's been quite difficult to get the iron nanoparticles into the aquifer, quite difficult to inject them. Moving on to the next point, in terms of applications, I think that we'll ignore that because I think that's a misprint in the slide set. The next point, I think, is this idea of the longevity of action, which people have already commented on in the talk. Now, this is something that I think is quite interesting because nanoparticles have a limited persistence in the environment. This has an impact on how you might use them. Perhaps it means they have an added usefulness in pathway management interventions through injection, in that the treatment agent that you're putting into the field does not persist compared with other chemical treatment agents, for example. There's a huge controversy about cost effectiveness. Pound for pound, kilogram for kilogram, iron nanoparticles tend to be more expensive than conventional zero-valent iron. So the argument really hangs on whether they're added value in terms of their ability to deal with recalcitrant contaminants, their ability to offer a complete destruction outweigh the fact that they cost more, and their ability to deliver treatment at speed. There are also a number of wider benefits, which Pete has touched on, for zero-valent iron in general, actually. And an important benefit is it's an in-situ redox system where you avoid tainting the groundwater. You don't turn it purple, like you might with manganate, and you don't make it smelly, like you might with biological treatment agents. Move on to the next slide now. Risks. Well, the major issue, we believe, for nano iron is perceived risks. There's a whole raft of concerns about nanoparticles in the environment, which are very similar to the concerns about genetically modified organisms. And we think that it's very important for this technology to avoid following the same pathway as perhaps environmental applications of genetically modified organisms have followed. And the reason why nano is considered to be so different, we think, is connected partly with the claims for nano about its increased reactivity, its special reactivity, because of its small size. In reality, we're not sure, but there is an enhanced risk from the use of iron nanoparticles compared to conventional zero-valent iron. The fate of the iron nanoparticles is rather similar to the fate of conventional zero-valent iron. They're converted into oxides. Next slide, 110. The difficulty that we have, and this difficulty is not just with the UK regulator, it's a difficulty that's mentioned by major site owners, international site owners. It's a concern that comes up in European Union reports. And it comes down to the fact that we don't have good information about the toxicology, ecotoxicology, impacts of human exposure for iron nanoparticles. We have lots of information about iron, but we don't have information about iron nanoparticles and their perceived special properties. We don't have tools which allow us to detect iron nanoparticles in the environment. And ultimately, we don't have tools that allow us to measure the presence of iron nanoparticles and risk assess them as we would, say, if they're a conventional trace element pollutant like zinc. And this drives a very big research agenda. If we move to our next slide, which is where we make our provisional conclusions. There are certainly niche benefits for using iron nanoparticles in remediation, particularly for problems that are recalcitrant, or i.e. not easily treatable by the things that we've got in our remediation toolbox already. But we're not convinced it's a substantial step change over what has already been available with other techniques. There's an anecdotal view. Anecdotal means it's a view that is based on opinions in the industry, but not substantiated, if you like, by scientific evidence, that the problem of actually getting your iron nanoparticles to contact the contaminant is a bigger problem than the risk of the uncontrolled migration of the iron particles, and they'll actually cause human health risks. In other words, what we're saying here is it's already difficult to get the iron nanoparticles to go to where you want them to go to, so we shouldn't really be so worried about them spreading more widely in the environment. And that brings us really to our hunch, which is that we don't think the risks of iron nanoparticle use in the environment are likely to prove unacceptable. But this is a hunch. So if we move to slide 112, the difficulty is that the technical evidence base is insufficient for us to turn this from being a hunch to actually evidence that key stakeholders require to allow them to support the release of nano-iron particles into the environment. They have to take a precautionary approach. And because of this, there's a big gap existing between what I guess we feel is true and the evidence that we actually have to demonstrate it's true. So if we move to the next slide, 113. So I've been rushing through these last slides because of time constraints. I guess where we are in our study is what's really essentially needed. What are the research essentials? What do we have to know in order to for stakeholders to feel comfortable about allowing the unrestricted use of iron nanoparticles in the environment? Or what is optional insurance? Is it really justifiable to invest large amounts of research money on the evidence gaps that are reported in the technical literature, such as things like iron nanoparticle, animal toxicity, special detection methods, for example? I think that the conclusion we're coming to for our report is that before we indicate anyone should invest this money, a good first step might be to use what are called expert elicitation workshops. I'm hoping that Paul Nathaniel will have joined us by now, because he's my colleague and this is his idea. I think we'll be proposing some structured workshops to basically look at what is the best case and worst case risk scenarios, and we might model then probabilistically how bad the worst case really is. So that's where we are now, and that's where I'd like to end our short slide set. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you very much. I don't believe that Paul Nathaniel has been able to join us on the phones. Paul, are you there by any chance? Or if you're streaming the audio, I had some email strings that were coming in that indicated he was stuck in traffic, but we can communicate with him. We're on slide number 114, which starts off with a voluntary iron nanoparticle register.
This is Marty. Paul, would you like to discuss that? You may want to take your phone.
Hear from John.
Oh, yes. John, if you would like to discuss slide 114.
If you hit mute, hit #6 to take yourself off of mute, John.
Can you hear me?
We can now. We thank you.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, as part of this report we're doing for DEFRA that Paul's already explained, we have a case study section where we're trying to kind of create an inventory or as many case studies globally as we can to get written up, just to show the evidence base of what's been used as pilot and demonstration scale. So at the moment we've gone through a very large literature search, and we've gone through 440 papers and read the abstract and gone through, and we've managed to strip out the lab scale and the full demonstration scale projects, and we've got up to about 50 field scale studies at the moment. But we set up this voluntary nano-iron register, which we'd like to invite people to complete. It's just 11 voluntary questions so that we can collect more information on more field scale studies. We're particularly thinking the studies that haven't yet hit the academic literature as yet. So if you've done a project sort of 4 years ago that's already in the literature, we'll have it. If you haven't, if you've done something more recently, please follow these links on resources pages and on this particular slide, and complete it, and we will definitely be putting it into the DEFRA project this week, if it's in this week, and otherwise we can try and provide some profile through the US EPA and CLARE in future. So thank you for that.
Okay, thank you, John and Paul. And at this point, we have about 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
We would like to open it up for a discussion on ideas about the benefits versus the risks of using nanomaterials for hazardous waste site remediation. Or I suppose we could also entertain additional questions.
Yeah, we have about 4 or 5 questions in the queue, and if the speakers are okay with that, I'd like to first turn to the telephone lines to see if anybody on the phone lines has any questions. Again, if you're on the phones, you can hit #6 to take yourself off of mute and ask a question directly to one of our speakers.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Hi, I'm Ian Thompson from Oxford. Being in the UK, I'm particularly concerned, as Paul suggested as well, that one of the big issues is the acceptance of new technologies. We kind of messed it up with GMs, genetically modified organisms, and we're in great danger of doing the same with nanomaterials, which is a shame since they've got huge potential. One of the things that worries me is the comparison between nanomaterials and GMs. One of the big differences, that the big concern with GMs is that they're self-replicating. You put them in the environment, they'll continue to self-replicate, and there may be an issue there, which normally there isn't. The difference in nanomaterials, they're not self-replicating, and that difference needs to be stressed, because if we're not careful, this situation will be bundled into one, GMs and nanomaterials, which would be, in the UK, totally self-defeating.
Okay, thank you. Would any of the speakers like to respond to that statement?
I fully agree with you, Ian. That's kind of what I was trying to say, but I didn't say it half as well as you did.
Great. Thank you. Anybody else on the phone line that has a comment or question? Again, it's #6 to unmute. We ask you only unmute if you have a question to ask.
Yes, this is Vicki Mert with the Kansas City District Army Corps of Engineers.
Go ahead.
Yes, I guess I've got two questions that are kind of intertwined, I guess. And the first one is that we're currently undertaking a project, both bench scale and pilot study on the use of nano/microscale zero valent iron. The setting is essentially a karst carbonate bedrock aquifer system, and we're looking at hydrofracking for the injection process. In addition, the one thing I've noticed in looking at doing some literature research and talking to some other researchers, it appears that a lot of times there's been a lack of geochemical modeling of the sites to try to see or try to determine potential side reactions that may happen. And so to that end, that's going to be part of our project. And so I'm just curious about some of the other researchers. Has anybody else gone ahead and used some geochemical modeling based on baseline post-injection? And then the second question is, and we've also kind of tossed around this idea, was the use of isotope fractionation to take a look at the biotic versus abiotic mechanisms. And then I'll go ahead and take it off the air there. I don't know if any other researchers have some input on that.
Thank you. Again, if there are any speakers want to respond to that question, go ahead and take yourselves off of mute. Well, then I assume that the answer would be no, that none of our speakers have worked in those areas or have information regarding your questions. One of the things I might recommend, if you could, is to follow up, send an email summarizing those comments and questions to us so that we can continue to work with you offline. They might have access to some information resources afterwards. You can refer back to the seminar homepage to find those email addresses as well. I'm going to switch over to the online questions that have come in, and I have a couple of them that came in. And the first one, again, this one's also coming in from Vienna, Austria, and they make a statement that ZVNI is not really easy to mix with TCE in the subsurface, as being shown by micromodels, and they're citing papers from Bauman or Charlie Worth and others. They tend to only stick to the water TCE or water sand interface. So does that mean it only treats the plume, or could you actually attack the plume itself?
Would any of our researchers like to take that question?
Hey, it's Paul Bardis here. As I understand it, I'll launch first, although hopefully Daniel and Michael will have a more technical view. The nano iron particles generally are working on the water DNAPL interface. But there's interest in including iron nanoparticles in lipid carriers. This is this emulsified ZVI, which NASA have produced, and their idea is that that will target directly the DNAPL pools by introducing the iron nanoparticles into the DNAPL. So hopefully now one of the other speakers can correct me.
Paul, this is Dan Elliott from UNC. I think you're absolutely 100% on the mark. In general, the various forms of NZVI, the flavors, tend to focus on the plume, and more recently on free phase source area, impacted by typically chlorinated solvents. There has always been a lot of interest in doing work with more recalcitrant compounds, some of the older classic pesticides, chlordane, dieldrin, things of that nature that are primarily sediment associated. And there is not a whole lot of work to report with some of these more recalcitrant compounds. Preliminary research shows that it's possible. The NZVI small size certainly makes penetration into contaminated sediments possible, but it is way far from being demonstrated as proven. And Mike, I'm sure you probably can comment on this further as well.
Yeah, this is Mike Borda. I definitely agree with you guys both. It's predominantly what we've been involved in has been plume treatment, dissolved phase, chlorinated ethenes, ethanes, methanes. And as I've shown in our slides, we have looked at some sites where PCBs were an issue, and that's another case where, you have strong sorption of the PCBs to the soil matrix, and treatment is difficult. You really predominantly are treating dissolved phase with a NZVI or a bimetallic nanoproduct, unless you're really using an emulsified oil or something like I think what Marty showed from Veritec. We're not looking at penetrating an apple body or anything that's going to enhance desorption of strongly bound materials to soils to get them into the dissolved phase to be treated. So. That's my take.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. In the interest of time, I'm going to take one more question that's been submitted electronically. Those of you that are with us streaming the audio, please know that I do have a copy of all of the questions. There were many more that have been submitted, and they will be shared directly with the instructors and your contact information so that they can follow up with you offline. As well, those of you on the phone line, if you have a comment or question, we haven't been able to squeeze it in, I would encourage everyone to go back to that seminar homepage and look up contact information for either myself or any of the speakers, and you can ask them a question directly offline. But the final question that I'll take comes in from Richfield, Minnesota, and they ask, currently, what is slowing or preventing the risk assessment studies and fate and transport studies for nanoparticles?
Well, this is Marty Otto. I can take first stab at that one, and then others may want to join in. I think one thing, there is a lot of research going on toxicity and fate and transport, of nanomaterials in general, but there are a lot of different types of nanomaterials out there. And so some researchers are focusing on nanoscale silver particles or carbon nanotubes. So I think that is one thing that is slowing down the research on iron. Frankly, some people are not as concerned about nanoscale iron and are more concerned about other types of nanomaterials that might prove more harmful to human health and the environment. So anyone else want to chime in there?
Yeah, Marty, yes. This is Mike Borda. I just want to, you know, add that we, you know, through our academic partnerships, we do have a number of studies that are going on currently, one in specifically at McGill University in Canada, looking at fate and transport of iron nanoparticles, and one at University of Calgary, also looking at toxicity of iron nanoparticles, specifically the ones that we've used in some of our implementations. So, but I do agree with you. I think in the scale of importance as far as nanomaterials go, I think iron sort of ranks much lower than nanotubes and silver, as you mentioned, and some of the other more high-profile nanomaterials. So that probably is limiting a little bit of the more high-profile research, but certainly there is a lot of work going on. I certainly wouldn't suggest that's a limiting factor on us moving forward as a community doing nanoscale iron work.
That's right. I agree. I wouldn't want to give the false impression that we shouldn't be doing research on nano iron, because as Paul pointed out, it's very important to have these results to either convince us that we shouldn't be using it or convince us that it really is not a problem.
Paul Vargas here. I'd like to add to what has been said so far. I think that Marty's absolutely right that there's a huge amount of research on, like, nanoscale toxicity, and it does tend to focus on things like nanosilver and carbon microtubes, and that is because things like iron nanoparticles are really more niche. Nanoscale silver is used in a huge number of consumer products already. The difficulty is that all of this nano debate carries the same degree of public dread. And this is why the regulators have to be very cautious, and they have to take a very a precautionary approach, at least this is the situation in the UK. So this is the dilemma that we face. But personally, I don't know that it's worth the huge investment in animal toxicity testing and developing special tools to detect nanoiron in the environment. I think that might be nice for a lot of people at the universities, but ultimately the fate of the iron in the environment will be as some form of an oxide, and that's what we should focus on. And as I say, I think a good next step, at least here in the UK, would be an expert elicitation workshop.
Can I just say something? I'm seeing Thompson from Oxford again. There is a difference I see between nano iron and the other forms of iron, the other form of nanomaterials we've been talking about. The other ones are likely to go into the environment unintentionally, where nano-iron, we're talking in this case, as an intentional release of quite a large amount. So it's a separate situation, different situation, as I see it.
This is Dan Elliott. What I think we need to keep in mind, and this harkens back to Mike's comment earlier, is that in almost every case that I'm aware of, the iron that has been injected into the field can only loosely be described as truly being at the nanoscale. It may have been at the nanoscale when it was synthesized or when it was manufactured, but because of aggregation and because of the inexorable and constant reactions with its surroundings, it's a reactive material. Let's remember the iron oxide shell is essentially not a whole lot different than the colloidal naturally occurring iron bearing minerals that comprise most of the Earth's crust. So that this may be a rather irreverent comment from a guy who's been doing this too long, but I think the real risk posed by the reactive iron core, for all intents and purposes, is a pretty minor affair relative to the risks that might be existent in the manufacture of the material.
I completely agree with you. But we need to get that point over quickly, because talking to the people making decisions, particularly in the UK, they don't see the difference. We need to stress it.
And Ian, it's Paul Bardas here. It's not just in the UK. There are major companies, problem holders, who will not use a nano-iron technology because they are concerned to be, they're concerned that there isn't a lot of hard ecotoxicological information, for example, about nano-iron particle impacts on, say, soil ecological functions. So this isn't a purely domestic issue. And all of us in this seminar are people who have some familiarity with the technology and some interest in the technology, but we have to, as you yourself said, be very careful to take the regulators and the wider public with us.
Well, thank you all so very much for that dialogue. We've gotten a little bit past our scheduled end time. And with that, I'm going to ask everyone to move along to slide 115, which is the very last slide in the package. And I'd like to cover a couple of closing items before we officially end today's session. First and foremost, I want to point people to the additional resources or links page, which you'll find on slide 115. If you've got a confirmation email from me, again, you can find the very same links at the bottom of the seminar homepage. There'll be a link to find additional resources. And on that homepage, or pardon me, on the additional resources page, you'll find a collection of a number of other websites, documents, as well as a link to the survey or register that was mentioned on slide 114. So we do suggest that you take a look at the additional resources page. If you're also looking for a copy of today's seminar slides, you'll also find that on the resources page. The second link that's shown on slide 115 is a link to our short feedback form. It takes just a minute or two to fill it out. We do ask that you take a minute or two to submit feedback. Please know that I do read each and every one of the comments that are submitted. And if you'd like to continue to see free online training such as this, we do suggest you fill out the form and let us know that you found this to be a useful expenditure of your time. If you're looking for confirmation of your participation today for training records for some reason, you can also submit a feedback form and check a box on that form to have a confirmation email sent to you for your own records. Then, again, also as a reminder, the entire session was recorded and will be emailed to all of the registrants afterwards in approximately 1 to 2 weeks as soon as the archive is available for free replay or download. And any questions that were not answered, again, I've shared them already with the instructors and would encourage you to go back to the seminar homepage to look up their contact information and reach out to them on your own. With this, I'm going to thank both Marty Otto from my office as well as Paul Bardos over in the UK for helping to organize today's session, as well as all of our instructors from across the world who joined us, as well as the nearly 200 people who signed in from a variety of countries. I was very surprised to see the international turnout we had today. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's presentation and that I'll see or hear from you on a future Clue and Internet seminar. This will be the official conclusion of the field-scale nanoparticles Internet Seminar on Clue. So thank you all. Have a great evening or rest of your morning. Take care.